Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you, literally, if you can hear the background, from the heart of Toronto. We are in the Rogers Centre. We're with Adam Chapman, my good friend and fellow podcaster, watching the Blue Jays versus the New York Yankees. And it can get loud in here tonight because it's a pretty packed house. Adam Chapman, how are you, good sir?
I'm great. It's good to be back on your show. It's funny because we just recorded an episode of my own show yesterday. So it feels like, in theory, we should have nothing to talk about, but that's never true when we get together.
It's true. And you can't pull the curtain back and let everyone see how the Wizard of Oz works.
Well, the question is, like, what's going out first, this episode or mine? I think it's mine, so I feel like it won't be ruining the illusion.
That's true. When is your episode scheduled to come out?
So mine has to come out on August the 12th. It's the anniversary of the show, so it has to come out on the 7th anniversary of my first episode.
That's crazy that you've been able to keep that and maintain that schedule. You're a little nuts, and I love it, but yeah. It's crazy.
It's funny, in the last few years, I've made it so that every year I always have the centennial on the anniversary, because that was not always the case. I probably took too many breaks here and there, or I don't know what I did, but eventually I was like, you know what? If I do this right, I think it was the 5th one was when I had to, I think I took like a week or two off just to slow it down, just so I could make sure it hit the right point. And so every year now I got to do the same thing. Got to make sure I slow it down just enough that I get the centennial on the anniversary.
So how does it feel, 700 episodes? Like, I know you're going to say, oh, it's kind of disgusting, it's gross, but you've had some pretty great conversations with some, it's a loose term that we say in comics, but legends, like comic book legends.
Absolutely.
How's it been for you, looking back to when you started your podcast and to where you are now? Like, if you ended it on the 12th, would you be like, that was a good run?
Yeah, I would feel like I got most of what I've talked about comics I love. I've been able to talk to creators that, when I started the show, I never could have imagined they would ever say yes. It's interesting, again, when I look back at some of the first interviews I did, and they were like Chris Claremont and Tom DeFalco, I started strong. In the first interview I did was with Nick Patara, who I love, from Manhattan Projects. But like after him, it was, Chris Claremont and then Tom DeFalco pretty close together, or maybe I'm inverting them. And that's kind of a crazy place to start. So I think if I'd stopped then, I would have been happy.
Me too. The same thing happened to me. I got Matt Kent, who I was extremely in his universe of all his books, whether it would be Valiant or whatever he was writing. I was reading a bunch of his stuff, so I was like, I sincerely love your work. I'd love to talk to you. And then after that was Jerry Conway.
Oh, wow. That's an exciting one.
It was, and I, you know how big of a Spider-Man fan I am, so it was just like, is it possible that Jerry Conway, the guy who, you know, wrote one of some of the most legendary Spider-Man stories, has said yes?
And infamous.
Infamous. That's true.
Legendary and infamous. He's done good and bad. It's crazy. I mean, it goes to the fact that we forget that, like, to us, especially growing up with some of these people, they're comic book legends. They're gods among men.
Yeah.
They are our movie stars in the comic industry.
We're so geeky, but it's true.
But you forget that, you know, outside of this niche, they're just guys.
Yeah.
Obviously movie stars are too, but they exist in a different strata. Whereas these are guys who can walk down the street and people don't know who they are. It's kind of like voiceover artists who could be like beloved by millions, but they would never know their faces, but they know their voice. It's kind of that same type of idea. So like, to us, we're like, why would Jerry Conway ever say yes? Whereas he's like, yeah, I'll talk to you. You know, like, someone has an interest in my work, I'd love to talk about my work, you know?
Yeah.
Especially, you know, let's be honest, like, Chris Claremont's best days are not ahead of him anymore. I mean, as a creator, he doesn't work on a lot of stuff anymore. His best stuff probably is behind him. No offense to Chris Claremont.
No.
But, like, his halcyon days are over. So being able to talk about stuff that he really loved doing and have people still care is pretty gratifying, I would imagine.
I would think so, too. But after I talked to Tom DeFalco,
I know,
he retired from podcasting.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting kind of point there, right? Like, there comes a point where you're also sad about everyone's only ever asking you about the past, not the future. And that's got to be hard. Although I'm curious, like, if you called up Tom DeFalco now and said, hey, I know I ruined you for podcast last year, but I love, you know, the issue of Sensational Spider-Man you did with the 10-pager. I love it. I know you're doing work in the Marvel Comics 1000. Would you talk to me about your current work?
Do
you
think
you
did
say yes?
I'm not sure.
Are you too shy?
Me?
Did you try to ask?
No, I would ask him.
Okay.
You see, when I spoke to him, I spoke to him about like some of the most current things he worked on. Like
I
did,
I did read
Reggie and Me, and I said I loved what you worked on, and it wasn't so much like, too bad you got no work coming up, Hal. It was
true.
Like you're still great.
Well, I should hope you don't enter it that way.
No.
Sorry, buddy.
Yeah.
It's not the '80s anymore.
Right. But at the same time, like, it's got to be pretty gratifying when, I mean, what do I know? But when you have had something to look back on, that it's like I've been talking to a guy at work because I've recently changed companies. I was with the same company for 14 years.
Wow.
And I, you know, kind of not at a drop of a hat. It seemed like it to people, but I changed, and people were shocked. Like, why would you change? There's no reason for you to change companies.
Yeah.
So going somewhere new and kind of being the new guy again,
mm-hmm.
and you see outside of your box,
yes.
a little bit. And it's the same work, exactly the same work, but you appreciate, like, wow, the person who taught me my trade taught me well. When I see what sometimes other places, how they do stuff, makes you appreciate it. So I say that to say this. I recently called the person that I apprenticed under, one of the people I apprenticed under, and I said, you know, there's three guys here that you train.
Oh, really?
And they're three of the better workers here, and that's because of you.
Oh.
Like, that's got to be that thing to make you feel it was worth it.
Sure.
You know, so in the case of a guy like a Tom DeFalco or someone who's no longer working day to day, you've left it. You're the reason people still read comics. It's because of you, what you did. So thank you.
Yeah.
It's got to make your life meaningful, right?
Yeah. I mean, I guess there is a diminishing returns to a degree because, well, I think in Tom's case, he's just a creator. He just wants to create. And it's maybe, and I think that's just the hard part, that, you know, why can't I still create stuff? It's a weird, it's kind of a weird ageist industry that kind of just ages out these old pros, whereas back in the day, the industry kind of took care of them and, like, kept giving them work. Like, when you see people like Ditko doing Marvel work in the late 80s, they were trying to get him work because he was a legend. And they're like, we want to keep this guy going. And maybe that doesn't happen anymore because comics are more corporate, that you don't have them kind of giving these legacy guys more of a shake.
Do you think that... I think maybe that could have something to do with the type of work some of these guys did. Like, Chris Claremont had a very specific style and worked on books that it's like, I need this much time to tell this much story, and it's got to, you know, he had his method. But then you get a guy like J.M. DeMatteis, who I don't think he's much younger or probably the same age as those guys, and he still feels like he's at his creative peak in a way.
I would say that Claremont's style, if you want to call it that, was very, very verbose.
Right.
And I don't think DeMatteis' style was verbose. I think his was introspective and more detailed, but again, not necessarily fluff. I think some people sometimes, and I don't know if this is correct or not, view some of Claremont's stuff as a little flowery, but style with no substance in some ways. Like, he spends a lot of time with very particular phrases, right? And, like, you can, if you look at his X-Men books, there's certain, like, the totality of Psylocke's psychic powers, like, that kind of stuff. Like, he had a lot of catchphrases or, like, things like that that he used, but again, a little bit more style than maybe more substantive stuff. Whereas DeMatteis, even when he gets very wordy, I never felt like he was giving me anything I didn't get on the page. He was going deeper. He was going into that character's mind. And
right.
I feel like when you read DeMatteis now, he's giving you the same stuff. He's still about thoughtful introspection. Because, I mean, you've talked to him. When you listen to him speak, you're like, of course he writes the stories he writes. Like, he thinks about this stuff. He's a philosopher. Like, if he existed 300 years ago, he'd be the one pontificating about stuff and coming up with this stuff. Like, he'd be like Descartes and, you know, thinking about existential being. Like, his comic books are a meditation on philosophy.
I absolutely love talking to him. I like, buy, like, I have books that I'm going to read just so I can go back and talk to him. Even if I did one podcast a year.
Did you pick up Moonshadow?
I did.
I haven't picked it up yet. Is it good?
It's a beautiful, like,
tome?
Complete, yes. You can feel like this is going to be special. I haven't read it yet because I want to be, You know, sometimes you got to be in the frame of mind.
Oh, for sure.
So you know, okay, yeah, this is where I'm going now. I'm putting away a little bit of the fluff and action-packed comics that, yeah. You know, I'm going to get some meat.
Yes.
So I'm it's sitting in a spot where at any moment I'm like, okay, I'm ready.
Any moment. It's going to happen.
Yeah.
The moment is going to strike you.
And you know, once you get into that, it's going
to... I feel like you need to have a pipe or like some scotch and you got to channel DeMatteis. I don't even know if he does those things, but he seems to exude a certain level of old school class.
There's got to be the music.
Yeah.
You got to have the right soundtrack to go with it.
You should just email him. Be like, I really want to read this in the proper frame of mind. What do you recommend?
Well, I asked him that question. Yeah. I said, you know, if you could have put a soundtrack to some of your stuff. He's like, well, naturally Moonshadow for Moonshadow.
Mm-hmm.
So
I didn't even thought of that. That's so obvious.
There were some songs that he listed that would, that like encompassed his work.
Okay.
I have to go back to the second interview I did with him to remember that. But yeah, I love talking to him. He's one of my favorite people I've ever talked to, I think, in life.
He's one of those people like, well, I've had a couple where, like, you just want the conversation to go, and you don't want it to stop. And he's definitely one of them.
Yeah.
Englehart's another one for me where
I was,
like, you know, he's just a cool, interesting guy to talk to. And actually, Eric Larson is another one where he's so unvarnished and just honest.
Yes.
And, like, he was just on the Amazing Spider Talk podcast. And, like, I could just listen to him talk for, like, hours. And, like,
he doesn't care.
Like, he's just so interesting. And, like, he's one of those guys where, like, you feel he loves the craft, loves comics. And, like, I almost feel bad that I don't read Savage Dragon. I feel like I should just pick up an issue and just start going, because I always feel like it definitely feels like he's all about giving you content and packing it in and telling comics in an old school way, and unfortunately that's not something you see as much of anymore.
Yeah,
there's a lot of booing on the field at the moment.
You know what's happening?
They're doing a video replay of something and a lot of people do not like it. I mean, there's anytime the Yankees do anything, Jays fans don't like it, so they are predisposed to already be upset. What were we talking about there?
We were talking about people that we enjoy talking to, like Eric Larson. And
have you talked to Eric Larson?
No, I haven't. Because
why not? He's amazing.
No, I'd love to talk to him. You know what it is for me? I want to go in as... I think I put too much pressure on myself to say I've read enough things to legitimize the reason why I want to talk to you.
Yeah. There's a fight on the field. And I guess against the umpire, one of the guys is attacking the umpire.
What I want to know is, what's he going to actually do to the umpire if he gets in his face?
I mean, nothing.
Right? Why are you holding him back? Let him go and talk to the umpire.
I don't even know. I think he called balls and strikes. There was a disagreement. I'm not even sure, but that's crazy.
Well, the sound in the background is wonderful, but they're not booing at us.
No. Will you keep this in? Or is this raw, unvarnished?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, people got to feel like they're here with us. When I'm at a restaurant and people hear the clanking of the forks, and it's all part of the ambiance.
The other day, so I was asking my wife, I was like, Kelly, I'm doing episode 700, will you do a segment? She's like, no, I don't think I'm going to do a segment. I'm like, okay, like, it'd be nicer if you did one, but okay, I get it. She's like, how about I introduce the segments? I'm pretty sure I did that last year. And I'm like, I don't remember this. She's like, are you sure? Because that's when you told me to make sure I enunciate Cave of Solitude. And I'm like, oh my god, I forgot about this. And she's like, I'm gonna do it again. And I'm like, all right. This is
maybe
this is actually the one bad thing about being at a live sporting event sometimes, is that you don't actually know what's happening on field. Whereas if you're watching at home, you know everything that's happening.
Yeah.
And there's no question. Whereas here, I'm like, what exactly happened? Why did they get into a disagreement?
You got to go home and watch the highlights.
Exactly. And that's kind of a weird thing to have happen, where, like, they don't want to show you anything on the big screen. Whenever there's anything controversial,
they're bison. They're fucked.
So, anyway, yeah. So something's going on.
Well, Gardner was arguing balls and strikes last inning before he got his double.
This is great.
Yeah.
Keep going. I can't hear you.
Okay, you can hear me?
I can.
Because otherwise, it's just a weird podcast with, like, a baseball conversation in the background. Not exactly a target audience. So, like, who else is kind of on that list of, you know, I'm so glad I got to talk to them?
For me?
Yeah.
Then Gardner came out.
So James Dimitaz was a big one. I enjoyed...
How did you become friends with Shane? I'm jumping all over the place.
Oh, how did I become friends with Shane?
Was it the podcast or was it Martin or like where was it?
Oh, okay. So Facebook is sometimes your friend.
Yes.
So I became friends with or acquaintances with people that you're seeing at certain conventions. So I don't know if you've listened to the episodes we did with Mike Ruth. He's a local artist from Oakville.
Okay.
So Martin was closer friends with him. So we went out to Oakville, spent a day, you know, at the park with him recording. And then there's been other events where it was like Pint and Pages, they called it, where I went to see Mike and see if I could get a commission or schedule him for a podcast. And Shane happened to be there. So I met him there.
Okay.
And then through Facebook, I think he had listened to one of the episodes that I had done with Mike Ruth or with somebody else that he knew and said, hey, I liked your episode. It was really good. Yeah. And just having bumped into each other,
yeah.
It's like, hey, we've actually met before. So then I scheduled him to be on the show. We hung out, and that was it. We became friends from there.
That's awesome.
And then Martin became friends with him by proxy. So it was all kind of like through podcasting. So I've made, you know, friends with you, friends with Martin, friends with Shane. So podcasting has, that's probably my favorite thing about podcasting. You would think that was a home run for our team.
I know, right? There's so much noise happening right now, but the Yankees have scored against us.
Yeah.
There's booing, there's cheering, it's hard to know what's going on.
I have a confession.
Yes.
I got back into baseball because of the Yankees when I was younger, like in my early 20s, and I used to come to...
That's allowed.
No, but I came to the Sky Dome back then
to see
the Yankees play. Because that was during the Blue Jays black and silver era, and I didn't feel like this is not my Blue Jays.
Okay.
So...
On the uniform, it didn't even say Blue Jays anymore, it just says Jays.
Yeah, so I didn't have that connection anymore. But the history of, like, the baseball history of New York versus Boston got me back into the sport.
Okay.
So I used to love coming here because it was like the crowd was so, there's so much animosity between which is the home team here. Even though you're in Toronto, it was such a split crowd. So that was a perfect example of that. And that was an exciting Yankee team during the Jeter era.
I really want to at some point go see the Jays play when they play in Seattle. Because that's basically a away game, but it's a home game, really.
Right, right.
So many people come down. It's mostly Canadians who just flock to Seattle just to watch those games. So I want to be part of that flocking at some point.
Yes, that was kind of the cool thing about the Raptors winning this year was seeing just how many people across Canada were all focused on us.
What's unique about only having one team is that when they do well, the entire country cares.
Right.
When they don't do well, no one cares at all. But at least when they do well, everyone bands together. I mean, in 2015, 2016, everyone across Canada cared about the Blue Jays. You would watch, you know, games in Minnesota, and everyone who lived near the border was coming on down to watch the Jays play. So, yeah, it really brings people together. It's something that people in the States can't understand the same way because they have so many teams and it's so regional. Whereas with us, it's really not.
Right.
Like, one thing I take for granted is that I have the MLB TV app, so I can watch every baseball game that happens. I can watch it on my app. Well, I forget when I go travel to certain places in the States, they have all sorts of blackout restrictions. Well, in Canada, I have to worry about none of that. So I can watch any game, all the time, whenever. I was in New York, I'm like, what do you mean I can't watch half these games? What's happening? But I guess it's because, like, they have local providers, and so you can't watch those games because they want you to have that cable package, not be able to have a much, less expensive package.
Right, right. There's more competition, I guess.
Yeah, so it's interesting. So podcasting has given you friends. I mean, you had friends before. It has given you additional friends.
Well, yeah, it's just kind of like, it's one of those things I didn't expect to happen that was like a happy accident because it was very natural. As unnatural as it might seem to make friends through the internet, but it's that common interest that we're all kind of very different.
Yeah.
But there's this thing that we have in common, and that I don't know what it's not just the commonality of comic books, but it's like beyond comic books, we like talking about all this other crap too. So it's just fun to be able to make friends with people that you would never expect. And the cool thing with Shane now, shout out to Shane, he always listens, is he's at Rate Studios. He's an artist at Rate Studios now. So I helped him move his art table to Rate Studio, and he's like, oh, I can't figure out the alarm system yet. It's kind of tricky. And so he's knocking on the door, and Ramon Perez opens it up.
Nice. That's awesome.
And Scott Hepburn is working there, and it's like, they're just regular. Like, hey, nice to meet you. And I'm like, yeah, you signed a couple of my books last year. Like, nice to meet you too. Right? You got that little bit of that, like you were saying, that starstruck feeling.
Mm-hmm.
But so that might be a good natural in with people who, you know, Shane is my real friend, so he could vouch for me, like, he's actually a cool dude. He's not just some fanboy trying to fake his way through.
It makes a huge difference.
Yeah,
it's interesting when we're talking about, like, you know, there are celebrities. Like, if you gave me, you know, Brian Michael Bendis and, I don't know, some TV actor who's pretty well known and respected, I would be more nervous to go up to talk about the Bendis. You know?
Sure.
You know, and like that's the weird niche that we're in. That there are superstars. Jeff Johns, if he was there, I'd standing at an airport waiting for some luggage, I'd be petrified to go say hi.
Well, when me and Martin met him when he was here for the, it's so crazy to think that when Doomsday Clock launched, he was in Toronto at Gotham Central. That was so cool to be able to.
That seems like a coup. Right? That's a huge launch, and he's in Toronto.
Right, and at 12 o'clock on Tuesday, we were able to get our comic signed by him.
Very cool.
That's very cool. And Martin was like shaking.
Wasn't that like 8 years ago though?
Right. Someone, my cousin asked me about Doomsday Clock. He wanted to read another Watchmen story, but this one that, you know, it's like the sequel tying in DC. And he's like, which version of it should I buy? And I'm like, just get it digital right now. He's like, he goes, isn't there a graphic novel? Isn't it collected yet? I'm like, it's not even finished, dude. And I'm so upset. I shouldn't be surprised, but they're doing the Volume 1 and Volume 2 in the hardcover.
Oh, are they?
They're doing 6 issues at a time.
I thought they were getting away from doing shit like that.
I thought so, too.
Like, I own All-Star Superman that way, and it bothers the shit out of me.
I didn't buy All-Star Superman because of that. I had the 12 issues, and I read it like that. But I'm like, I don't want a Volume 1 and Volume 2.
It's in a consolidated volume now, and has been for quite some time.
Yeah.
But I
reads much better.
I bought it earlier when it was the 2 volumes, which now I'm just like, ugh, why do I own this?
Yeah.
Like, I should have known. Like, that's actually why I didn't buy Hush for the longest time in collected format, because it was only in those 6 issues each. I'm like, I don't want to own this way. I want to own it in one trade.
I bought Hush originally in that format when I first got back into comics. That was one of the first books that I read, and I hate looking at it on my shelf because I want to get that one consolidated trade for it.
I think I have the deluxe hardcover of that. I think I forgot I have it.
Really?
I think I own it. I feel like I got it from, like, my mother-in-law, which is, like, crazy that can happen now, but because of Amazon and wishlist, this is possible.
Yeah.
It's the type of thing that years ago never would have happened. Like, my mother-in-law, who knows nothing about comic books, has given me... Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah.
It's funny because my wife never buys me anything off my wishlist. I'm like, it's right there.
My wife did that last year for anniversary. It was so funny. She bought me 3 omnibus. And they were all good ones.
I think one time, I mean, she's brought me some comic stuff here and there. Usually she tries to go a little bit deeper and not just get me the actual comics or omnibuses. She'll never buy me an omnibus, refuses to buy an omnibus. But I remember one year she bought me, like, tons of Jonathan Hickman stuff, all his Image work, because I was really getting into all of his Secret Warriors and all that. This is, like, years ago. So he had a lot of Image work that was in trades, like Transhuman, Red Mass from Mars, all that kind of stuff. So she bought a bunch of these. Anyways, for, like, years afterwards, once in a while, Amazon would be like, do you want this new book by Jonathan Hickman? She's like, fuck off. Like, I do not want to buy this. She's like, you ruined my Amazon. I'm like, sorry, babe. That's what you get for buying things from me.
You're part of the algorithm now.
Right?
Got you.
They're really sure that she loves Jonathan Hickman. That is not a thing that's true.
So you mentioned Hush, and it's funny because the movie, the animated movie, came out this week. I think it's this week. I just bought it today, and before I came here, I watched it with my wife because that's her favorite Batman story.
Okay. So you're going to watch it with your wife, or you have watched it?
We watched it, but she dozed off in the last 20 minutes. She was like, I saw her, like, fading out, but it wasn't because she wasn't enjoying it. But It's actually a very good adaptation of the book.
Is it in kind of the current continuity of those movies?
Yes. Yes, it is. So
Damien's around?
Damien's around.
Interesting.
But he's not prominent in the story. He actually has a cool... his cameo in it, or his appearance in it, is very, like, fitting.
Okay.
Because it's... most people listening to this should know or have read Hush at least once, whether you love it or hate it. But in that story, it's the one where Batman reveals to Selina Kyle that he's actually Bruce Wayne. So, spoiler for this, I won't get into more of it because you haven't seen it, but it's Damien saying, so now you're dating criminals? Well, I understand you're getting out your carnal desire, but, like, you're taking her on a date? Make sure you do this. Make sure you have a condom. Make sure you, like, all of these things. Like, haven't you learned from my mother that you should watch out for women? That's sort of his...
I hadn't even thought about the fact that Talia is in the original in, like, kind of a very interesting period of her life. Because she was the head of... wasn't she the head of LexCorp at the time?
Yeah. Yeah, she was.
And it's interesting, like, is she in the new movie?
No,
how could you reconcile her being there and having Damien around? It's just this weird thing that didn't exist at the time.
I think about that too.
Person, Damien.
Right. That's the one thing, because when they were first releasing these DC animated films, I loved them so much because they would take these classic stories and adapt them, change a couple things, but they were their own standalone movies. But then when they started the Justice League War, that Batman or that Superman had an ongoing story. So when they had a solo movie for them...
Here's my problem. I haven't watched Hush, so I know nothing. But my problem with it is that it feels like it should be in and of itself its own thing for one reason specifically. And that's that if you look at all those other ones where they adapted specific stories, they all aped that art style of the original. So you're adapting Hush, one of the most seminal, most evergreen Batman stories that you'll ever see on a show, by one of the best artists of all time, maybe not best storytelling, but definitely one of the most iconic artists of all time, Jim Lee. And you're not going to ape his art style?
Right.
What are you doing? And I guess part of it's because they're fitting it in with this already established aesthetic that they're doing. But you know what? Break from that for a movie or do it as its own thing. But you're doing a disservice to Hush because, like most people, let's be honest, Hush is a good story. It's fun. It's popcorn, right? But what makes it good? Is it the art? Or is it the story? It's the art. Like, if you could give up one of the two things, if you could give up the art or give up, you know, some of the writing on Hush, what would you give up first? I give up the writing, because I can still have the beautiful pictures.
Yeah, because Hush is definitely, like, looking back at it, it's a book. Jeff Loeb's smart when it comes to marketing his story and seeing who his artist is. And he said himself, like, I was writing this for Jim to draw a greatest hits so that everyone could see him draw the Joker, see him draw Harley, see him draw all of Batman's
characters. And it does feel like that.
Yeah, it is. Like it's a greatest
hits. It's kind of a, like, who can I get in next?
Right.
But it works. Got him. God's stealing.
Yeah. And it's a great story, I feel, to get people into comics, because it's one of those books where you can jump in and it explains certain aspects of Batman's life without you having to have read 30 years worth before that or whatever comes before it. That's the one thing that it made me fall back in love with Batman, and all the little things that I knew throughout history, like I knew that Jason Todd had been killed by the Joker, or I knew that certain things had happened between his relationship with Superman, or whatever the case may be. They're referenced. And just enough, you know, just enough to keep going with the story. The one thing, though, about the movie, I'm not going to say what it is, but they changed something. It's done pretty... They go through all of the beats of the story from the comic and adapt it to the movie in a pretty honest way. But there's one aspect, I think, of the movie that is very different from the book. Play is under review, everybody. For those not here,
you can tell that they're showing a review of it, and we're pretty sure he's safe. Yes. See if they overturn the call.
Oh, that was very good. Oh. Someone stole third. We thought he was out, but it was safe. And this is not a Yankee call in favor of the Yankees. This is for the Blue Jays.
Jays bring the winner call.
Woo! So the one thing, even for myself, reading Hush, when you get to the end of it, I feel a little confused.
Okay.
I'm not exactly sure what happened when.
Okay.
Whereas in the movie, it's very clear. This is what it is. They kind of fix that hang up that people have with the book.
Okay.
It's so, and it's different, but it works.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
I've been meaning to watch it, but I'll have to watch it.
It just came out. So you're not behind.
Hasn't it been out digitally for a while?
Maybe digitally, you're right.
I think it was out like 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Yes, you might be right. I always buy the physical copy of my superhero movies, so I don't pay attention to the digital.
Are you patiently waiting for Endgame?
Yeah. Yeah.
How patient?
Isn't it coming out Tuesday?
I think so now. It's been out for what, a week and a half now digitally, so.
Have you seen it again digitally?
I've been only about 10 times. I mean, not very many, you know, like maybe 10, I don't know.
How does it hold up for you?
Very well. Actually, you can listen to my episode 700. I do have a tangent on it with Nathan Strzok, where we talk about watching it again and certain things about it.
Okay.
Because I mentioned something that struck me when I was rewatching it that I found I was fast-forwarding the Thor scenes a little bit. I was not super invested in some of the Thor scenes, but we talk about some of the stuff he loved about the Thor scenes, which definitely made me maybe come around on some of it.
Okay. Yeah, see, I thought the Thor stuff was good when I saw where life had taken him, but I was hoping that it wouldn't continue that way through the whole movie. That was when I saw it. I'm like, okay, now we're past that. This is Thor. Let's get him, whip him back into shape.
Okay. Fair enough, yeah.
But I understood also what they were trying to represent as well. Because,
depression?
Yeah, yeah. And
different forms it can take for different people.
Exactly. And I think that when you sit back and think about the world you live in, and what would actually happen, I mean, he's still the God of Thunder. He's still got the power.
Yeah.
But
the cheese whiz flows through his veins.
My favorite line from the movie was Rocket telling him, "You look like melted ice cream." Does the digital version come with the added scene? Did you see the added scene that they put in theaters to get people to go back?
You know what? I believe it does. I didn't even check it because I was too busy. I'd already seen most of it because most of them are all put online.
Oh, okay.
So I didn't even check. I think it does, but I already watched them all online like the day of release. So
would you say, I had my cousin ask me this, or said this to me, goes, the other day. He's a Star Wars fan.
Okay.
But he said, I think Thanos might be the best villain in a sci-fi movie. Like, he might even surpass the Emperor and, you know, dare I say, Darth Vader. And this is a Star Wars guy. What say you?
I mean, I don't think it's fair because, like, when Star Wars happened, all you needed was a cool villain. You didn't need to give him motivation. Like, it wasn't really required. But I think as a movie-going audience, we expect all of our antagonists to have some kind of personal motivation, or at least to have some sort of, you know, more. We expect more from our villains in terms of their worldview and knowing more about them, and having more drive. So I don't know if it's fair to compare because, like, they spent so much time. Like, Infinity War really is Thanos' movie. It's his heist movie. Like, Endgame is the time heist, but the first movie is Thanos' stone heist. You know, like, how can I get all these stones for myself? And it's so he's more thrilling as a result because you understand his perspective. And they make it not personal, not petty. They make it big, and that's kind of cool. So I think, yeah, I kind of prefer Thanos, but there's also something raw about Darth Vader because you don't know what he's thinking. You don't know what his motivations are, at least at the beginning. Like, in the first two movies, the first movie, his motivation is what? Just doing something. Like, but that almost makes him scary.
Yeah, I think it's the all the things you didn't know about Star Wars that get added on through that novel has this insight, and that novel tells you this secret. It adds people's, like, the diehard fandom of it, because you've got to really search. Everybody, that was the Blue Jays home run.
It was indeed. You know, it's funny. The last time we were at a game and doing a podcast, the Rays were winning so badly, and then the minute we stopped podcasting, the Jays had a historic comeback and took the game. This game is the opposite, where the Jays are actually doing quite well.
They're kicking butt.
Yeah, they are.
The Yankees, but
it's funny because the pitcher who's pitching was our pitcher last year.
There you go. Sweet justice.
That's what happens when you come back to Toronto.
we're talking about Star Wars. So I think that the lack of information created the hunger for the fandom.
Yes. So actually, similar but different. I was talking about this, I guess, on podcast in my 700th episode, not to plug my own show again. With my friend Nate, and we were talking about how it's so interesting, like, there's certain things that we missed out on when we were kids, or we only had an idea of something, and we would spend years wondering what happened. Like, for years, I had read most of the chapters of Maximum Carnage, but I had somehow missed chapters 1 and 14, and I didn't know how it started, and didn't know how it ended, and I just wondered for years, and I built it up in my head. And then it was just exciting when I finally got to experiencing. Whereas these days, if you missed it, you could find a synopsis in 5 minutes. Like,
yeah.
Like, if I was trying to remember something and I couldn't remember it, I could look it up, and then that moment is gone. And there used to be something to that these moments are these things that you spent years trying to figure it out, and that it would stay with you forever.
Yeah, the payoff meant more.
Yeah, because it was something you earned, and so that moment would stay with you forever. And like I think I've said it on your podcast before as well, but you know, I watched when I saw the first Back to Future movies, I watched episodes 1 and 3, and I missed 2 with the second one because my parents didn't watch it on TV and didn't record it. And it was years before I realized I was even missing something. And then going to the local, you know, video store with my parents and trying to find if they had Back to Future 2, and then taking it home and watching it, and it blowing my mind that I missed it. And it had taken all these years to be able to fill in the blank. And that would not happen now.
Right.
If you missed it, you could buy it that afternoon. You could be like, well, it's on digital, let's buy it right now. Whereas for me, it became like this thing that was imprinted on my psyche. Even same thing with Star Wars. I saw episode 4 and 6. I didn't see episode 5, same thing. My parents never saw it on TV. They never recorded it. So I missed it for years.
That was me with the Superman movies.
Okay.
I had Superman 2.
Yeah.
Superman 4 on a video cassette.
Yeah.
That I just killed the video cassette. I just watched it again and again. But the last part of Superman 4, where he speaks to the audience or the crowd at United Nations.
Yes.
It didn't make it onto the tape, so I missed that ending of the movie.
Oh, really?
I had seen it, but I didn't have it on my video cassette.
Okay.
And then I had finally gotten part 1 on beta.
Wow.
Right? And I watched the crap out of that.
Yeah.
And then on a... we had TBS for a couple years. For some reason, it was part of our cable package.
Yeah.
And on TBS, they showed Superman 4 with all of the added scenes included in it.
Oh, wow.
Which blew my mind, because I had a book, like a young reader's book of Superman 4, Quest for Peace, and it had these pictures that I had never seen in the movie.
Wow.
And I'm like, where is this in the movie? And TBS showed it. And so it just like made the movie seem so much more important to me, even though it sucks. And Superman 3 was like that Easter egg, that thing that, like, for you, the Back to the Future 2. Not quite as good of a movie, but I had such an affection for it because it was the one that I had seen snippets of.
It's the one that got away.
It's the one that got away. So I had seen it, but I didn't have it accessible to me the way I wanted it.
Mm-hmm.
So when I finally, my dad dubbed it, because that's what we did back then.
Nice.
Just watched the crap out of it.
Yeah. when I was 10 years old, a kid at school gave me a comic he didn't need anymore. X-Men number 20. But he didn't need it anymore because he had cut pieces out of it for like a project, an art project. And then he gave me the issue at beautiful Andy Kubert art. And I love that issue. But for years, there were pieces of that issue I had never seen before because I had pieces cut out of it. And then finally, and I never bought the single for whatever reason. And then they in the X-Men Skinning of Souls trade paperback, they had that issue in there. And it blew my mind. I'm like, I don't remember this at all. But in my mind, I could actually, it was funny, I actually took a piece of paper and put it, cut out a little box and put it on the panels that were originally cut out. I'm like, this is how I remember this page. And now this is what it really looks like. And it blew my mind. Because again, like I had remembered for years, I had this weird cutout version of this comic, and there was stuff there that existed that I'd never seen before.
Was there a comic that you, as a kid, it was on your list of like, one day I'm gonna own that book? And it's not necessarily a book of value, like right. not like a Spider-Man, Amazing Spider-Man 121. Just a book.
That's
that,
the one.
That was the one for you?
I don't own it.
No, but is there one that you ended up buying?
Oh.
Just for the story, because you're describing this X-Men 20, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's not that it's an expensive book. It's just like, I need that book because I want to read it. I want to see it. I used to see an ad for it in the comic book magazine.
Well, so my most common answer to that is actually trade paperback. Iron Man, Hands of the Mandarin. Because as a kid, I had one chapter of that. One chapter. And I was entranced by this chapter. And I never saw it again elsewhere. And there were six chapters, and I would go to comic conventions, and I would see most of the chapters, but it was always missing one. I'm like, well, I'm not going to buy it if I can't get them all. And so for years, I only had my chapter, which was like chapter two, or maybe three. I can't remember. But and I would see, and I remember this back when they had letters pages, and they had like cover art for the upcoming issue, which was going to be like the big climactic ending. And so for years, I had never finished it, and I wanted it so bad. And so finally, they announced it was coming in trade paperback. I think it was when Iron Man 3 was coming out. And it blew my mind that this was the Iron Man book that they decided to reprint at this time. I'm like, are you kidding me? But you better believe I pre-ordered that, and I waited for that Amazon delivery man to bring it and put it in my hot little hands. And I opened that, and I read it feverishly. And it was not very good, but I didn't care. Because that kid inside, who only had one chapter of this six-chapter storyline, but loved it so much, could not wait. And actually, a year and a half ago, I reached out to the author saying, can I please interview him for the show? And like 2 weeks ago, he's like, I missed this message. I'd be interested. And I'm like, oh my God, I have to talk to the guy who did Hands of the Mandarin? This will be a total full circle for me. I don't know if it's quite the answer you wanted.
No, it is the answer I wanted because it is the answer I wanted because it's the honest one. I didn't usually.
Although I will say, Amazing 121 is a big one for me because I have always loved Gwen Stacy as a character. I've always loved the original Green Goblin. I remember way back in the day, just when I first read The Death of Gwen Stacy in an old Marvel Tales reprint. Not the first time they reprinted it, but like later on. I remember like I think it was like a friend of mine, and he didn't even want the Marvel Tales. And it was both issues in one, like 121 and 122, in one oversized Marvel Tales issue. And I loved it. It was a cool cover. It was, obviously, they made special covers for those Marvel Tales. But I was just like, man, I want to own this someday. And someday I hope to. I need a beater copy. I need like a 1.0. Like, I honestly don't care. I need a copy that looks like someone has loved it before me. I don't want a graded copy. I want to read something I can read.
Yeah, I agree. I wouldn't want one. That's my holy grail book too.
Although would I read it? Here's the thing. Like I don't care about collectability per se. I'm not buying it for that reason. But a part of me is also like, would I touch it? Would I take the chances of it falling apart?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I found a couple of issues that were on my like wish list, all time wish list. One of them was Batman 252 with the Joker holding the I found that book in a reasonable condition for $14.99.
Wow.
At ABC Books on Yonge Street. And I couldn't believe it. I said, I looked at the guy, because I'd shopped there pretty frequently, and I'm like, this is $14.99? He's like, yeah. He knew what he was pricing. He goes,
okay.
I know people are going to see that. And it's like, it's the condition it's in, and it's not in bad condition. It might be like a 6-7.
Yeah.
But, you know, speculators are going to come here.
Although I do feel like most of us, when we look at a book and say it's 6-7, it's really probably a 4-5, because, like, I know how crazy these people are with grading. Like, I feel like everything that a regular person would think of, we got to take it back a few notches.
Maybe, but I gotta tell you.
Not taking anything away from your copy.
No, but...
You did buy it.
I did, oh yeah, of course, because it was...
You could not.
There's no tatter on it.
Wow.
Even the cover might have, like, a couple of, like, those white marks, maybe by the staple.
Yeah.
But... It's definitely not a perfect mint condition, but for a book that old, to just be able to find it for less than $20 is pretty ridiculous. And the other one was a copy of Spider-Man 300 that I found. $30.
That's not bad.
Paradise Comics. It was just in the back bins.
Wow.
I'm like, $30. Because you see battered copies of that at shows, and they're still $200.
Oh, it's crazy.
I think that, for me... That's the most sought-after book, overpriced sought-after book, because I think there's a lot of them out there,
yes.
But people just buy it for what they feel is, such an important issue. But I don't think that issue is as impactful, because Venom just pops up right at the end.
Yeah.
It's not...
Wait, are you talking about $299?
No, 300.
300 is in the full issue.
Is he in the full issue?
Yeah, 300 is the big fight. And
when
Spider-Man wakes up at the church and he's all webbed up, and Eddie Brock starts saying, you know, this isn't going to work this time. The church bells aren't going to get rid of me.
Yeah, you're right.
It's $299 that he shows up and is like,
all
honey, I'm home.
Right.
Not to correct you on your show. You can edit this out, or you can edit, or you can manipulate the voices to make it sound like I'm making a mistake.
I got no problem.
You can write in like a white knight and fix it.
Yeah, but like after when I got like the trades, or even when I had the issue, like I was happy to have the issue because I always wanted it, because the cover is everything, right? But it was just one of those, like, for me, I still feel Spider-Man 400 is more of a story that is like, oh, that's the story.
Yeah, I agree. It's interesting. I think my relationship has also changed with comics, because we all kind of know that comics aren't really worth anything. Like, it's hard to sell comics. If you ever try, it's almost impossible. So I feel like these days, it's more about, like, can I read this issue at some point in a format that I like? So, like, I don't need, like, as much as, I guess Death of Gwen Stacy is probably the one kind of holdover from me being a kid that I'm kind of like, no, I'd really, really like that. But other things, I'm like, you know what? If I can have an epic collection with that story, that'll be fine.
Yeah, I'm the same.
I can still read it.
That's the same.
Like, I'll never not be able to read these comics. And again, we're at this point where eventually most stuff gets reprinted somewhere. Someday, somehow. Yes. It's not always going to happen the way you want it to, never always in the format you want it, but it's probably going to come to you in some way.
Yes.
And that's very exciting, because like 20 years ago, that's why people snapped up the issues. Like, if I don't buy this issue, I can never read this comic.
Yeah.
It'll never be reprinted, especially if it was like a weird comic too. You'd be like, well, there's no chance this will ever be reprinted. And now you're like, eventually, it probably will be. And that's kind of crazy.
Right. And I think for me, buying some of those issues, I put them up decoratively in the house. Like, this is sort of my, that gem that I found that is meaningful. Here's where you can read it. But it serves, it's almost like a picture, because it's that, this is something that was on sale on a newsstand in 1975 or whatever the year was, and it was disposable. People would have this at a barber shop and it would be tattered, but there's something important. Those, what's special to me about those books, like ASM 121, is that it's the story. It's not the number of the book.
Yeah.
It's not the cover or the variant or anything like that. It's the meaningful story and how it changed the character.
Yeah.
That's what those comics.
When I was younger, I definitely did some of that kind of cherry picking. Like, first appearance of like, the Morlocks. I really wanted to have that in Uncanny X-Men. Having Uncanny X-Men 200 or 201. I mean, these were like notable books because like Xavier goes to space, Magneto becomes the Headmaster. You have the first appearance of Nathan Christopher Summers. Like all this stuff. As a kid, I definitely bought into that a little bit. I didn't pay a lot because I didn't have a lot of money anyway, and there maybe weren't the best copies. But it was definitely something that motivated some of those early purchases.
for me, the one thing that I want to try to do is complete the Infinity Gauntlet, because I have four of the single issues.
Really?
I've got the number one.
Okay.
I've got the one where it's just Thanos saying, come and get me.
Of course.
I don't remember which ones I'm missing. I have them both close by where I can be like, okay, this is what I need to look for. But now, they're just to complete it, you'd probably be paying so much more for those issues 2 or issue 5.
Just wait a couple of years.
Yeah. There's a
lot of hype right now that will go down.
Yeah, maybe. And that's something, though, that might plateau and stay where it's at because of the impact the movie is now going to have on pop culture as a whole. Like, I don't think that the importance of that is ever going to go away, because it's not like Death of Superman that they printed millions of them knowing that it would be or a collector's item.
Yeah.
Like, Infinity Gauntlet was a big deal when it came out, but it was a big deal for comic book fans, not just a random person off the street to be like, hey, true, we better go and get 10 copies of those to put the kids through school, sort of thing, right?
No, that's not, you're not wrong. That is an interesting point, yeah. Like, it was big for the industry, but not outside the industry.
Right.
Whereas the Superman changed everything.
Yeah.
Not necessarily for the better.
I think it was both, right? Because people, it's like...
Well, I would say it's the beginning of the devaluation of death in terms of what it matters in a comic book. It's when they first really learned that death will sell comics. Because I would say before, deaths were not motivated by sales and felt more motivated by story. Like, look at that.
I agree with you, Adam.
Yeah,
the crowd agrees with you.
An amazing play by one of the children of the Blue Jays. What a play. So I feel like you go back and you look like the death of Jean Grey. That was not done as a commercial stunt, or at least commercialism in comics was very different. That I don't think you would be like, I don't think you'd think anything less of that death. Even the death of Captain Marvel, like, it was more of like about the story and about what it did for the character and not necessarily the money. Whereas Death of Superman was about the money.
I think Death of Superman is more reactionary initially, to be like, they've messed up our story plans.
Yes.
What the heck are we going to do?
True.
So let's do something. Because we're kind of pissed off, let's do this thing. But I think out of it, you got some of the best stories of Superman. Because I think any book, what makes Spider-Man special, what makes Batman special, is not just a titular character, even though that's the reason we buy it. It's the fact that J. Jonah Jameson angers us. It's the fact that Robbie Robertson, how does he fit into the narrative? So it's those auxiliary characters that bring up the main character. So with Death of Superman, him being off the main stage, you're dealing with Ma and Pa Kent bearing his teddy bear.
Although I would argue, and I mean, if you go back and listen to my episode with Jerry Ordway, it happened years earlier. Like, they really had a concerted effort to build the ecosystem of what is happening in Metropolis. So I would say it happened before the death of Superman, but it definitely made the death of Superman resonate more because you knew all these characters, and now you got to see how they reacted to an event.
Yeah. Now that you bring that up, like when you were talking to Jerry Ordway, the things that they did that era of Superman between, like, starting with Byrne, but then him and Stern and Jurgens, I think that's somewhat of an overlooked era of a book.
Oh, completely overlooked.
The art is great and the storytellers are fantastic.
Yeah. And now, I mean, when that period starts, there isn't as much, you know, kind of cross-connective tissue. No. But it builds and builds. And then, like, that's why a lot of people will say, like, what do you often hear about people who love Superman from the 90s? They love the triangle era, right? Or the S.H.I.E.L.D. era, or whatever. They had the little triangle that said 1994 issue 3. So this is the third issue in the sequence. That was such a revolutionary kind of concept. Now, again, it may have been alienating to some people at the time to be like, oh, fuck, I got to, you know, read all four of these Superman books. But for people who are really invested and love that world, you felt like you were, it was like a TV show. You were getting a week to week, which is how I felt with Brand New Day at Spider-Man. Like, every issue was like the next chapter, and you got it fast and furious. And if you didn't like it, you moved on to the next story pretty fast. And that's what I loved about that whole era.
Yeah.
I wonder, back when issues had full stories, beginning, middle, and end. You do not get that anymore. So you couldn't do that as the same way now. And again, that's why I give credit to Brand New Day, where, and even Big Time when Slott first started, is that all of his stories were really fast and paced, and they're like one issue here or two issues there, maybe a three-parter. And even in Brand New Day, it wasn't until, what, 20, 30 issues in that you get New Ways to Live, which was like a six-parter. But like you, and by then you felt like you earned it. Like you had all these smaller stories. It didn't mean that they were, sorry, small in stature. They were just shorter.
Yeah. I just, speaking of Brand New Day, reading that volume, I think it was volume 3 that I had finished last, and not every story is groundbreaking, but when you get to the Spider Tracer killer and you realize the conspiracy to it, but you've invested in these characters up until that point, and you're like, oh crap, like, they're in on it. I did not see that coming. Even though I've read this before, I completely forgot. And it, and like you said, you've earned it by that point, which is not so, like, nowadays, I feel in my reading experience, especially with DC, not that the stuff isn't good, there is a lot of good stuff, but because things get restarted, I feel like, got a home run, Vladimir Guerrero Jr. almost got a home run, didn't happen.
Did not have the distancing. So you were saying?
I was saying that it feels as though the stuff, the stories that are being told today don't have, it's almost like, okay, we've moved on from that. That doesn't matter no more. Because they have some really big things happen to characters.
Yeah.
But then it almost feels like it's erased because they restart everything.
Yeah, or it just kind of ends up going back to normal.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and the X-Men are probably the worst for that recently because it feels like they're so compartmentalized. You get, you know, a run and then it ends and then they just kind of go on to the next thing, kind of forgetting about the rest.
Yeah.
Whereas there was a period of a lot of progression that, in the late 2000s especially, where you felt like each X-Men story, I guess up until AVX, they were all building on each other, and the precipice that characters like Cyclops had to walk was becoming so narrow, but it was interesting because you felt that they were getting pushed and pushed and pushed, and then after that they're just kind of like, yeah, then it's been an endless cycle of relaunches, and you feel like you're losing the core continuity. And then, like, you have a guy like Jonathan Hickman comes in, and he's going to rebuild it all, or kind of tear it all down and do his own thing. And kind of like, I'm excited for that, specifically because I believe of anyone, I trust that he's got a plan. He knows where he wants to go, and he's going to get us there. Where I don't have that faith in a lot of creators to actually execute and have such a crazy vision, he's going to make it happen.
I think, though, yeah, I agree with you. And I think Jonathan Hickman is a guy who's proven to be like, give me this book, give me the room to breathe, and he really gives you, I said this on the last episode of my road trip episode. I forgot what I call them now.
Drive-bys?
Road report. Where he gets a book and really affects the whole feel of their universe. Like he did it with the Avengers, where he has his, you know, graphic design niche thing where you feel this. I'm in the Jonathan Hickman world right now. And it was the same world you felt like you were in when you're reading Fantastic Four. And he weaves that sort of like, I'm sure with the X-Men, because even with that first issue.
Have you read the X-Men ones?
I've read House of X number 1.
Oh, man. You gotta read House of X number 2.
I do. I know it's gonna get collected.
That book is everything. Like that. I read it. I'm not gonna spoil it for you, because I wouldn't do that to anyone. But like I read Powers of 10 number 1, and it was good. And there was a page in it that I'm like, I don't know if this is landing for me the way I think it's supposed to, because I had heard this one page was chalked up everywhere, and I was like, I don't get it, but I'm sure I will. And then House of X 2 came out, and holy crap, like it felt like something that changes something, it adds something, and but reframed so much. And it was one of those issues that I feel like I could complain about it and say, from a plot progression point, it gives you almost nothing. But I so did not care because I was so riveted by what I read that afterwards I was just like, everyone needs to read this so I can talk about this because it was so exciting. And I need you to read it because
you need to read Power of 10 in order to get that.
I mean, yes and no. Like, the moment there's a panel or a page that Hickman has said is the most important page in X-Men history. He has said it all, and that page has been online. And I didn't get why, or what it meant, or what it really was saying. And you see this page in Powers of X. But don't worry, you also see it in House of X 2. But in House of X 2, you have context for what you didn't understand in Powers of X 1. And then you go, oh, I think you need to read Powers of X. I don't think you should deprive yourself, because those books are telling the same story, but in a different way.
Gotcha.
Again, I'm trying to be as vague as possible, because I really don't want to ruin it for you.
No, that's fine. I appreciate that. I know that because it's coming out weekly, I think it's... I saw it on Amazon to be released. I don't know if it's in December or before that.
The hardcover's coming out in December, and it's like $50 on Amazon. It's got all 12 issues, both 6-issue. I'm really curious how they're going to collect it. Is it going to be one and then the other? Or are they going to alternate issues in the reading order? Hickman is a guy, more than any other creator, you know, he's actively involved in the collection process. He helps design his own omnibus.
You're right.
Like, he is involved in every presentation. Him and Ed Piskor, I guess, are the guys who, you know, that their fingerprints are on every iteration of their book. So I believe, when you pick up that hardcover, it's going to be the way he wants it to be. It's going to be true to his vision. Like, the back matter, the text pages, apparently, he's created a language of Krakoa. And, you have to, understand the language. Apparently, they were in certain places in the States, in certain stores, they were giving away Krakoa seeds. This whole concept, I feel like he's a guy who embraces everything about the multimedia in his project. It's not just the writing, it's everything.
Yeah, 100%.
I don't even know what I would say to Hickman if I met him. Because I'd just be like, I'm dumb compared to you. Like, the way he thinks things out, the way he contemplates. Like, read issue 2 of House of X and tell me that you would have come up with that. And I would say, no, I don't think you would. I would say you're an outright liar.
Yeah, I completely understand what you're saying.
To the point where I almost want to hit pause and give you the issue right now and say, read this, talk to me in 5 minutes or 10 minutes, and then we'll talk about this, because it's really good.
You've got them both there.
I have it here.
Yeah, we're going
to
take a look at it.
Honest to God, if you want, you can pause this podcast right now. You can read this issue as I enjoy the rest of this baseball game, and we can come back and just talk about that for a few minutes with a spoiler warning that, obviously this is a big deal. But just talk about that one thing.
Okay, let's do it.
Want to do it?
Let's do it. Yeah,
let's pause.
Okay. After these messages,
we'll be right back. Gather round, boys and girls. It's story time.
Okay, we are back. I took a podcast break. Seventh inning stretch.
Yep.
We read House of X 2. Adam Chapman said it was the most important page in X-Men history. It was a great issue. And pretty mind-blowing.
Yeah, it's crazy. What I said before...
Let's spoil the crap out of it.
Yeah, spoiler alert from this point forward. So what I said before you read it was the idea that it was additive, not subtractive. So it adds something to the mythos of the X-Men. And a pretty big piece, and kind of makes everything reframe everything you've ever read in X-Men, because the idea is that Moira has lived 10 lives. Well, this is her 10th life. And that this is the one where she decided her and Xavier are going to change things. So it's like, okay, well, where are they going to go? And it's what I like about it is it doesn't mean that Moira can necessarily affect certain changes on reality. Things are going to happen a certain way. But the decisions she makes are going to change. So if she decides to do something that she did before, it'll be similar than before. It's just interesting, what kind of weird stuff, how do you come up with this? How does Hickman go to bed at night and wake up and be like, I got it? Moira is a mutant the entire time, and she basically is Groundhog Day-ing herself into life, and she's lived these 10 lives. Like, it's kind of crazy. Where does that come from?
I don't know. I love that stuff, though. And that's so, why. That's
still
what,
sitting with you?
Yeah, of course, because, I mean, this is the stuff you read comics for, right? As silly as it is, when people are like, ah, you read these kid books or coloring books, you know, you're reading... I had one person say, you still read cartoons, you're so stupid. But meanwhile, when the movies come out, everybody's inspired, right? Everybody's like... It's almost... There's... Even when you watch something as much of a blockbuster as Endgame, it's those moments of Cap's life having come full circle, Tony's life coming full circle. It makes you reflect. And in a story like this, as science fiction-y as it is, there's a lot to unpack there. And not to say that we know people who are groundhog daying their life, but yeah, the imagination of creation is incredible.
Oh, for sure. I mean, so again, it really makes me take stock of, like, Moira does everything for a reason. And the fact that Xavier knew of all these different realities that she had lived through is also really fascinating. Like,
right. See, now that you mention that, I got that. But now that you say that, when he met her, he knew she had all of this inside of her.
Because she said, read my mind.
Right.
So that moment where she's like, do I know you? And he's like, we go back quite a ways. And then he's like, what? And he's just, you can read my mind. She gives him permission to go in. And then he go, and then just that look in his face of, ah, like, that must be crazy. Can you imagine, like, you're a mutant now. You have this ability to read people's minds. That's kind of mind-blowing in and of itself. This, you meet this person who says, who actually acts like she knows you and has a familiarity with you that you can't place and you don't know how, and she gives you carte blanche. She says, read my mind, which to a telepath must be almost sexual, like, or sensual, because that's such an intimate act. You know everything in and of that person.
Of course.
I mean, if you think about it, like, in your relationship with your wife, my relationship with my wife, it's not just physical intimacy. There's an emotional intimacy that no one will ever know me, in theory, as well as my wife. She will know pieces of me that I have kept hidden from most people, but she will know that most naked, scared version of my, most vulnerable version of myself. So
she should, right?
Yeah. So you take that even further, where you have a telepath, and you say to that telepath, I give you permission. You can come in. Again, maybe I'm reading a lot of sensuality here.
No, because
intimacy.
Because I think even this, like, there's a lot of things that I would assume or even hope that we all have thoughts in our mind that we're like, I don't want anyone to know that I thought that. So to let someone get in there, that's the most intimate thing you could possibly do.
Plus, this woman at this point has lived 9 complete lives. And so she is not just giving, like, this is everything about me and, you know, the embarrassing little ha-ha-ha tidbits. This is the darkest secrets. Like, I killed every Trask I could get my hands on in one reality, and it didn't matter. Like, it was chilling to read it. And the reason why I said, like, it doesn't really necessarily move any plot forward, it doesn't. It's basically a giant info dump or, like, a Wikipedia entry. But I was riveted the entire time because I was just so in. I was like, yeah, this is crazy. Like, when you read the first one, and you're like, is that Moira MacTaggert? Like, none of this lines up with what I know about her. And you get to the second page, you're like, her second life, you're like, what the fuck is this? Is this MacTaggert? And then you realize it is her, and you have all these connections, and again, you see similar pieces. Like, you see Phoenix 5, the idea that certain things are predestined or are going to happen in these realities regardless of her decisions is also fascinating. Like, it asks so much about free will and how much one person can have an effect on the universe. And we always got used to the idea that it was Xavier, right? Like, the Age of Apocalypse is all about, if Xavier wasn't around, this is what happens, right? But now we've learned so much more that depending what Moira does changes everything. Like, R616 is because it's Moira's 10th life. That's the only reason why the reality we have is the reality it is. That's crazy. And is it a divergent reality completely? I guess it has to be. If she lived that, but how do you even chart that on a chart? Like, even the chart at the end is just charting the lives, not necessarily the realities themselves. Again, it asks so many questions. There's questions I want to know the answers. And what I also wonder is, this is issue fucking two. This is, like, what crazy batshit stuff is coming when we've only gotten the second issue? You know, the first issue was all about you're disoriented. We got all these new ideas about this reality. You have all the queer, crazy Krakoa stuff, and you're trying to get your mind around it. Then you read Powers of X or Powers of 10, and you're trying to understand, like, it's time jumps, and we're seeing the future. Okay. And then you get to this, and you're like, what am I reading? And again, this is only the beginning, which means there's only more crazy stuff in theory that could happen next, which is what makes me even more excited. So when I could not help but gush, this is why.
Get you. No, you ever have the experience when you read a comic or a story or a mini series, whatever it might be, and once you're done, there's a lot of books I read. I'm like, that was fun. That was a lot of fun. I like that. That was good. Mm-hmm. Hey, this is good. You should read it. Great spy story. Great, yeah, you know. But then there's some that make me, for me, I just sit back and I think about my life. And like you said, the concept of choice, free will, the effect that you have on other people's lives, like all of that coming into play. And it's not to say that the comic book is it's not our reality, but it's the concepts of these things that, for me, I just take pause. I'd be like, what does this all mean?
Yeah. So I kind of put it into two distinct groups. There's the books that sit with me, but not because I'm necessarily asking the big questions, but more because I was so riveted and so invested that I almost had to stop and put it down. Like, I remember when I read the end of the Sinestro Corps War when it was first happening in Green Lantern 25, I remember needing to sit with that. First of all, it was a hefty, giant-sized issue. And I remember certain pages there just being, I could feel the energy crackling off the page. I could feel the energy. There's a moment in there where Sinestro is powerless at this point. His ring is exhausted. He's just standing there. Hal Jordan's across from him with Kyle Rayner. No one has a power ring that works. And they just go, and he's just like, bring it on. And these two guys tackle him, and he's taking it, and he's just fighting them. And I just remember being like, holy shit, this is going down. And like, that sat with me a while. Like, that was a true experience. That felt cinematic. It really meant something to me. I remember there was an issue of Daredevil, I think issue 48 or 49 of the Bendis run, where he's fighting what's his name? Bullseye. And it was back during the not greatest costume era of kind of taking the inspiration from the movie, so he had the target on his head. But there's this moment where Daredevil takes a rock and starts carving into Bullseye's skull, like into his head. And he's along those lines. And he's like screaming at him. And the type, the font is getting larger and more jagged. And you can feel that he's getting angrier. And every shot that Maleev did, you felt the anger, you felt the power. That sat with me. Like, the emotions of the page were rippling off. I remember reading it on like a hot summer day in Toronto. I was walking back to work from the comic book store and just being like, I cannot put this down. I don't care if the pages start to ripple because it's so humid out. Like, I didn't care. Nothing mattered. Just this page. And it just felt, I was so invested. I was just like, whoa. So it's different than this kind of more philosophical whoa. And kind of needing to sit and let the ideas wash over you. But it's just that comics can have that effect. They can really grab you by the nuts and say, I've got you now. You're mine.
Especially because it's such a personal experience, whereas when you're watching something on TV, it's paced for you. They're showing you, this is how he flies.
Yes.
Whereas when you read it in a comic, it's... Tom King was saying this on a Word Balloon. I just listened to him on a Word Balloon today. He was saying, in a comic book, you are deciding how Superman flies in your imagination. It shows you there he's flying. But from one panel to the next, you come up with the pace of it, the power of it, the speed of it.
Yep.
And sometimes when it's translated onto TV or film, it's like, that's not how I imagined it. So, yeah, comics have that effect.
You're almost like the editor, right? Because, like, you have all the pieces, but you edit how they actually work. in your mind. Right?
Yeah.
So, like, you kind of decide in your mind how fast all the frames are moving.
Yeah.
So if it's like a moment where you're slowing it down for yourself, it's because you're slowing it down. Whereas, as you're right, when you're watching a movie, the editor and the director have purposely slowed something down. Like, in Endgame, when, spoilers, Captain America picks up Mjolnir, there's that moment where you see the hammer silently being lifted. And you don't even see it actually, like, you don't even see the hammer, the part where you actually hold the hammer. You just see, like, the bulk of Mjolnir itself slowly lift. And there's, like, an absence of sound. And you're just like, it's almost like you have your heart in your chest. Now, they want you to feel that, and it works. But, yeah, it's because it's a very deliberate choice. Whereas, you read a comic book, you are deciding on that pacing. I mean, Scott McCloud really goes into this in his understanding comics about how important the reader is to understanding how it gets developed and what happens in the bleed between time in these panels, because you as the reader get to decide that, whereas no other medium is so subjective.
Yeah, I think I said to J.M. DeMatteis when we spoke to him, there's romance on the Jumbotron right now, that's why it's getting loud. I feel, in my imagination, I look at a comic book page as a picture frame or a window into the other universe that exists in that black hole that we can't get to, but that's their story over there. And like you said, the way the time bleeds in between those panels is you controlling how that story is being told to you, but it's happening somewhere. It's just that on our end, someone's gotten the vision to draw it out to tell that story. Losing my voice again.
That's a very Earth 1, Earth 2 way of looking at it.
Right? Yeah.
Because, like, because Barry Allen became the Flash because he read the comics about Jay Garrick, and then he meets Jay Garrick, right?
Right.
Back in the day. So it's a very kind of that. I mean, even Gwenpool is kind of based on that premise, right? She's from our world, and then she found herself in the comics. But she knows everything about comics because she read them. So her book is half the time is about, like, I got to be a main character, otherwise I could die. If I'm a main character, I'll never die. And then when her book was ending, it was very metatextual because it was like, my book's ending. What do I do with the pages I have left? Which is crazy. Like again, Gwenpool's not a book that should be existential, but it is. And it's one of my favorite comics of the last 10 years because it allows the character to really, first of all, grow, but also really speak to you, the reader, in a way that you can't with a regular character.
Right.
If any of that made sense.
No, absolutely, absolutely. So is Gwenpool the one that made you have that moment of... If life is being explained to me from the pages of, this is how many pages I have left, I got to make the most of it to make it count. Did I have that moment of, for you to be like, maybe life, that's like a metaphor for life?
I don't know if I really put it that way when I first read it. I think I was just more like loving everything about that comic, and it was so delightful, and it just... It made me connect with the character, and it was just fascinating. And again, that book has my favorite portrayal of Batroc the Leaper, or Z-Leaper, I should say, because it makes him a real character. And when Gwenpool says goodbye to him at the end of the book, she's like, I'm going to miss you because you're not going to be this way again. And he doesn't understand what she's talking about. And I think that's what made it more heartbreaking, is that this character is a comic book character, so he doesn't understand that what she knows, that the writer will be different, and someone will write Batroc a different way, and he's not going to be this version of the character anymore. But she knows that that's gone now, but he'll never know because he doesn't have that awareness. Like, it's crazy. Have you read Gwenpool? I think we've talked about this before.
No, I've read some of the first issues of it.
Gotta read all of it. It's the 25 issues.
I have the whole collection.
Okay, good.
Yeah, I bought it on Comixology when you suggested it, and it's all there.
Not all great. Like, some of it, obviously, like any book, there's highs and lows, right? But I would say when they knew they were going to be canceled is when the book became the best it's been. Anyways, that's my diatribe on that. So getting back to House of X, I was trying not to oversell it, but like, it really got me thinking. It got me so just interested in, what do you do next? Where do you go from here? What does this mean for the X universe? What does it mean for X-Men history? When you frame that everything that Xavier's done, he knew what could happen because he's seen these nine other realities where something played out a certain way. So Moira's trying to rebel against what seems to be an absolute or something that has to happen. And so when she gives someone advanced knowledge of all this, what does that mean for predestination? What does that mean for true will? is it a boon? So something that she gave, is it a gift that she gave Xavier, or is it a curse that she gave him by letting him know about her other 9 lives? What does that mean? And what does it mean that it was only the 10th time, the 10th reality, that she finally told him? Is it because it was potentially her last one, or was it something else? I don't know. And again, we're only at issue 2, so all of this could be coming, or none of it could be coming. But I just, it made me ask. And I'm
so
excited.
That's the important part, though, is that it makes you ask.
Yes.
Because comic books can conveniently make a few moves to say, you know what? That was something, a tidbit of information we gave you, but now this event happened, so all those lives are erased, and Moira really just had, like, they could mess around and do something like that. But this issue, this feeling you have, will always make you think and ask those questions for yourself.
Well, it's interesting. It's also the idea of, like, that moment in time that makes you feel a certain way. So as stupid as this is going to sound, on the way here today, I was watching some videos on my iPad, and I forgot that last year, and actually even earlier this year, when the Infinity War trailers came out and when the Endgame trailers came out, I had, you know, basically saved off YouTube, like, high-definition copies of that, put it on my iPad so I could, like, get pumped, right? So I went back and watched the Infinity War trailer, and, like, obviously I know how the movie turns out, but, like, there's something about the magic of that trailer that transforms me into the kid who did, or the guy who hadn't seen it yet. So even though I know exactly what happens, it's still filled with that level of excitement, partially because of how well done those trailers were. And even the Endgame one, watching it again, like, it recaptured that level of excitement. Like, I know what happens in those movies. I know what works and what doesn't. But something about that moment and that anticipation I felt going into those movies, I get to recapture that by watching the trailer and remembering what that felt like.
I get you.
It's very strange.
No, it's not. It's not. It's not strange, because it helps you channel that feeling of, this is why this mattered to me. And sometimes you gotta get back to the basics of, here's why I felt this way about this thing, and I want to experience that thing again. You gotta remove yourself a little bit sometimes from stuff in order for it to be meaningful again. When it's always in your face, it's like if I read too much of one team or one character or one writer, after a while it starts to lose its resonance. It doesn't resonate the same. When you get back to it, it's like, I missed you. This was special.
Oh, for sure. The absence says that her heart grow fonder, or whatever that quote is. I mean, it's true. You miss something because it's not there all the time.
Right. Right.
It's like when we don't podcast for a while, you miss me that much more.
Yeah, but see, I could podcast you frequently. I think the problem is me and you would just be there for hours, because our wives are like, what do you guys talk about for all that time? Like, these books you're going to buy? Like, don't you have enough books?
Well, see, my wife knows that if I'm talking with you, I'm not talking with her about it, so she's cool with it.
Right.
One time I was like, man, why isn't Eric Anthony here? And she's like, shut up. But I'm like, because he would understand what I was talking about. Like, sometimes I just have to get it out, and I tell her, and I know it's not going to matter, but I'm like, you're here. You're right. The person. You
yeah,
know?
Right.
And then I'm like, man, if only Eric was here, he'd get this.
Yeah, exactly.
It's getting loud in here, Kevin. This is very loud. How much of this comes through on the podcast? I'm always curious. Like, you've got your headphones in, so you can kind of hear what it sounds like, right?
I can hear you clearly.
Okay.
But the crowd,
when the screaming
comes, yeah, we get lost.
You know, this is the closest
sure.
you and I will ever come to doing a live show.
You never know. You never know. We're still young enough that we could be panelists at a Comic-Con.
But let's be honest. This is probably our shot. This is us in a public place and making it sound like people care. This is pretty exciting right here.
It's practice.
It's practice.
It's practice. You got to visualize it, believe it, and it'll happen. It'll manifest itself.
I'll take that. So the game's kind of winding down. Should we wind down this episode?
Yeah, we could. We could. Okay, I wanted to ask you yesterday when we were podcasting.
Yeah.
Some of the stuff that you've read recently. What's some of the stuff you've read recently? Other than House of X.
I mean, like, yeah, that's one of them, right?
Let's say a trade. Let's say, you know, something.
Well, one thing I will say I've really been enjoying, at least the first arc, I don't think the new arc started yet, is I've been really enjoying Savage Sword of Conan, the newest series. The first arc was by Duggan and Ron Garney. Really loved it.
I recommend it, because I'm on the fence of, am I going to buy it? Do I want to get it? Should I read Conan?
Man, it's fun.
Yeah,
you know?
I think
it's a fun read. Like, again, I've never read Conan before in my life.
Yeah.
And it was exciting. Like, I like Ron Garney, so it's not like it's out of my comfort zone from an art perspective. And, you know, it's cool. And I've read the regular Conan book as well. I even read the Bellet Age of Conan series. I'm actually really digging Conan. Like, I there might come a time when there's just too, like, I read a bunch of it, and I'm like, I'm not really feeling that magic. But, like, when Star Wars came back to Marvel, I felt the same way. Like, the first
Star
few
Wars
books,
was incredible.
The first few books were so solid. It felt like you're reading a movie, and I was just like, I'm in. And then eventually it went on, and it was still good, but it didn't have that immediacy, that excitement of that first arc. And maybe I'll feel that way about Conan someday.
I was going to actually ask you if we could read the Kurt Busiek Conan run. I have the digital omnibus. Yes.
I think I told you, like, yeah, you got to buy this
$1. I started reading it. I was enjoying it. I'm considering getting the series because I think it's that run is 3 epic collections.
I believe so.
And I'm definitely considering having the physical copy, but I do have the first 19 issues in digital. We should read it and do an episode about it. Since both of us are we're noobs to Conan, right?
We are. And I feel like even if you know Conan, everything is so different. Because I don't know what the continuity of Conan really is, but it just feels like you can just tell a Conan story.
I think that
like,
is
I feel like he's kind of ageless for the most part.
Yes.
Like, you'll see stories where he's King Conan. You'll see stories where he's the younger version. But, like, I feel like, you know, they all kind of just exist. And that no one really is that worried about continuity. Now, I could be completely wrong, because, again, I haven't read the original Marvel omnibuses. I haven't read the Kurt Busiek stuff. But I'm curious, like, I think you can just, if you have a good Conan story, just do it, and people like it.
Unless
you're Brian Wood. I think he's one of the people who, I think it was Conan, where he said he got backlash about it, and people weren't really digging his Conan stuff. I haven't obviously read it, so I can't speak to it. But I can't imagine not liking something Brian Wood does.
Okay. So, yeah. I've been definitely very close to, because I went to my shop and I didn't buy Conan the Barbarian the first week that it was released in trade.
Okay.
And then when I went back to get it, when Savage Sword, because I was going to buy them together, he had no more Conan the Barbarian.
Okay.
So I was like, do I want to read Savage Sword, or which one do I want to go? Do I have, like, they don't crisscross. They're obviously two separate stories. But I feel like I'm supposed to read the main title for some reason.
I mean, I guess Jason Aaron, I believe, is going to be doing Conan for a while.
Right. And it's Jason Aaron.
Yeah. Whereas Savage Sword is going to have more rotating teams. Like, I think Jim Zub is doing one with the Conan the Gambler. So, I mean, if you want to see one writer doing a more of a sustained run, then maybe go with Conan. If you want to kind of see other people getting a kick at the can and see what happens with it, then maybe try Savage Sword.
Yeah. I'm gonna go for it. I enjoy fantasy a lot, but I'm not heavy into the sorcery part of it. So that's always been my kind of thing. I'm really gonna like it.
So far, I would say there hasn't been too much sorcery.
But see, this is the weird thing.
The sorcery that's there doesn't feel like it's out and about crazy sorcery. Like,
right.
It's more of, like, you know, curses and that kind of stuff, but not to the point where, like, it ever took me out of the book.
Okay, yeah, gotcha.
And you still got, like, swashbuckling, especially in the first... Like,
I love that stuff.
In Savage Sword, you got a little bit more of the swashbuckling so far. But, like, it's fun, and I guess for me, it's so far out of my wheelhouse that makes it more exciting, because I've never really read that stuff.
Yeah, and see, for me, I really like Conan-esque characters, if you will. Like, I don't think Thor is a Conan character. They're very different, but they're also very similar because there's that Viking aspect of it. There's that, you know, that warrior, Eternal Warrior from Valiant Comics is very Conan-like. Exo Man of War has that Conan aesthetic to it, and I love those characters.
What's stopping you?
You know what it is? It's more of a, where do you start?
Well, I think you just start with, I think with a character like Conan, I think you can pretty much start anywhere and just have a good time.
Yeah.
I think you can pick up the Roy Thomas and, you know, Barry Windsor Smith stuff and just have a grand old time. It doesn't need to feed in anything. Like, that book has its own continuity because you had Roy Thomas writing it. And besides that, you can just have an adventure.
If you
want to read the current stuff, read the current stuff, because it's your, maybe it's the art you like. Or, you know, I feel like now that it's
back under the Marvel umbrella, I feel it's a little bit easier for me to gauge, like, okay, that's what this is, that's this era, and now we've got, you know, because before, when you would go to the shelf and it was now under the Dark Horse imprint, it was like Chronicles of Conan, number 17. Number 9, it's like, do I have...
I'm scared of big numbers. I'm calling 17 a big number, by the way. That's how bad the industry is now, is 17 is a big number.
Right? So it's these collected volumes of different eras.
I have to interrupt. Do you know what the longest, not legacy numbering, but current numbering, what the longest running current numbering comic in Marvel is, or what the top two are?
That has never been interrupted?
So far, like, as of right now, like, I'm saying, throw the legacy numbering, that doesn't matter. Because if you restart Amazing Spider-Man, it's restarted, right? So which one has the highest numbering that has not been restarted currently?
In Marvel. Give me a second. So they restarted...
Whatever your first guess is, no.
No. I know it's going to be something really unexpected. It's not Avengers, because that restarted with Jason
Aaron.
That's
around issue 22 or so, so it's far too young.
Yeah. Spider-Man is in 27. That restarted. Thor restarted again.
Yes.
I'm trying to think of stuff that I read.
Probably not something you've been reading.
Really?
No.
Are they an Avenger?
I would say one of them was at some point, but is not right now. And calling her an Avenger, I said the pronoun. Calling her an Avenger may be going too far. I think she may have only been tangentially related. And the other one, not an Avenger, I believe.
Are they team characters?
One of them, has been on a team before, but is not at the moment. And the other one, not really.
So one is a female.
I only know this because I listened to the Battle of the Atom podcast today, and Jordan D. White was on it, and they mentioned this, and they talked about the top two.
I'm going to say Miss Marvel?
No, because that got relaunched to the Magnificent Miss Marvel. It's at issue 3.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Shoot, you're right.
And I would have said that she was part of the team. She's a champion.
Yeah, you're right. And she was an Avenger, too.
She was.
Spider-Gwen.
Spider-Gwen recently was relaunched. She's in, like, issue 3.
Yeah, you're right. Ghost. Wow. You know it's a good shot with anyone. I think that's the second of the night for Hernandez. See, I'm paying attention. I give up.
You give up?
Should I keep trying?
I will tell you, one of them you would not read, probably, or if you've ever read it, you didn't like it, because of the artwork. And I also have this problem.
Oh, Squirrel Girl.
That's correct. Number one with a bullet is her.
She's getting canceled, or it's ending.
Pardon me?
That's ending now.
I know, but up until this moment at least, it's currently the highest numbered book.
What issue is it?
It's an issue like 45, 48 or something.
Wow.
And guess what's number two? I will tell you, it's a team-up book that I love and I read to my son.
The Avengers?
No, it's not Avengers. It's a team-up book, not a team. It's a team-up. It's two characters having adventures. They're wacky. They're silly. I own a beautiful trade that covers the first 12 issues of it that I got for
Devil Dinosaur and Moon Girl?
Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur. Second highest numbered book currently being published at Marvel. And the minute Squirrel Girl goes away, it'll be number one. It's 1 month behind, I believe. Isn't that crazy? Everything else has been relaunched so often, but those books somehow still have the original numbering. And they're still going after 4 years. Which doesn't sound like a long time, but in current publishing, that's like super long.
It is. And I think...
It's like three relaunches.
I think all of that is a product of our attention span for how we view TV and our need to...
On the Battle of Atom podcast, Jordan White said, we know people don't like it, but like sales go up. you know, you relaunch with issue number one, more people are buying your book, then it goes down, and then you rinse and repeat because you know that issue one will be higher than issue five, whatever the case is.
And Marvel's doing a lot of these five-issue miniseries lately.
Yeah.
And they're good. They don't suck. Like, a lot of them are good, but the truth is, like, the Sentry one that I read from Jeff Lemire,
which is actually going to be talked about in episode 500. Dan Gavazdin talks about it and puts a spotlight on it.
That was a good little miniseries. That it was five issues, but you think it could go further, and it's like, that's it. That's all they're getting, unfortunately. And it's good that these stories exist, because I think people nowadays with Image and all of these other imprints that have these finite stories, whether they're 60 issues, 25, whatever the case may be, people are now like, I want something that is this, and I can put it on my shelf and read it, and I'm good with that.
Yes.
And then you got the people like us who just want to read everything.
Yes.
And we're happy with everything, and we're unhappy with everything. Why is this already being relaunched? Why haven't they relaunched it?
I mean, ultimately, it doesn't matter, right? As long as the book's good, I don't really care.
That's all I care about.
Like, I mean, it makes me sadder that they do these short-lived nostalgia plays, like, hey, look, fresh start, everything's back to its old numbering, and then 8 months later, everything goes back to new numbering. I'm like, fuck, guys, come on. And it is bothersome that Amazing Spider-Man issue one was 802, because they couldn't just end at 800, because Dan Slott needed his last story that was a quiet, more character-centric piece to be an 801, as opposed to adding it at the end of 800, which is already giant. So instead, you have those weird legacy numbering. Issue number one, but it's 802. I'm like, come on, guys. It couldn't be 801. It was too hard.
Do you think... See, I don't really care, but a part of me feels like if Hickman is going to work on the X-Men, however long he's on X-Men, don't restart that numbering, just like he was with the Avengers. But they restarted it, right, when Time Runs Out? Did they restart the numbering when Time Runs Out occurred?
No, they kept the numbering.
Yeah. So let that person have their 60-issue run, whatever it is, and, you know, if you want to read what Hickman or whoever did, if they're going to have that time to do it. Kind of like King with Batman, right? He had his 85 whatever issues.
You know, it'd be audacious, and they would never do it. But can you imagine going to the store and picking up Batman by Tom King, number one? And when Batman by Tom King is done, that series ends, and now you read Batman by Grant Morrison. Like, it's on the title. Like, it's not just he's the writer, it's his book. And the minute he's done, he's gone. It's a new volume. But, like, it would never happen because too many people would be like, what happens to continuity? How does this work? And, like, what's the sequence? But there's something attractive to that idea.
I think so, because I think we're enjoying... Because I've skipped... There's a lot of stuff where there's the completist in me where I want to try to read every era of Spider-Man's life because, to me, there's something to it.
Yeah.
But then with the X-Men... There's like a 10-year gap, 5-year gap. I don't care. I don't feel like I need to know what happened unless I'm really, really interested in a writer or something they did that comes back to matter. But I don't ever have that desire to go, like, I need to read the Grant Morrison era, because I feel that era is so beloved and so special for some, and for others it's like, that's not my X-Men. Whereas Astonishing X-Men, I feel, is no matter what kind of X-Men fan you are, that one's going to hit home.
Yeah, I think that's probably correct.
Right? So there's certain characters where I'm like, I don't need to read that era of that character. I'm good. I can skip that.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah, I guess that's very true.
Because, like, there's Straczynski Thor.
Oh!
Which is a short run, but pretty meaningful to people who read it.
Yeah.
You got the Jurgens run. That is its own aesthetic. But if you don't read one or the other, you're not going to not be able to enjoy Jason Aaron's Thor, which I think is a good thing.
Yeah, it is a good thing about the segmentation of Marvel, yes. That it becomes more, not enclosed, but yeah, you feel like you don't have to read it and you can still get it. Like, you picked up House of X number one, and you're like, I'm gonna read this. It doesn't matter that I haven't read anything in a long time. So here's a question for you as we wrap up. Do you think you can wrap up faster than this game does? We have one out left. Bring it home, Eric. Bring it home.
Well, thank you guys for listening to us have our annual Chatting with Chapman at the Rogers Center. I love these episodes. Hopefully we can continue making it an annual thing. You can make sure you check out Adam's 700 episodes coming out August 12th, which will probably have passed by the time I post this, so that's fine. And you can email us at caveofsolitude@outlook.com, follow us on Facebook, and leave us a review on iTunes. Adam Chapman, thank you once again for the baseball tickets and for a great conversation.
And you did it. We're out.